Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, quick word from a sponsor. It's Sock Fancy. And Sock Fancy is what you might expect. It's a sock company, except instead of going to a store, Sock Fancy sends the socks to you. It is a random selection of awesome socks shipped anywhere in the world to your door once a month. They've got hundreds of designs. You'll never get the same pair twice. You can exchange it if you don't like a pair, and you can cancel anytime. The socks are hip. They're cool. They feel good. They look good. Go to sockfancy.com/longform. That's sockfancy.com/longform and enter the code longform at checkout. You'll get a free pair of socks added to your subscription. It's a good deal. Thanks, Sock Fancy. Here's the show. Hello. Welcome to the Longform Podcast. I am Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey. Hi. Good morning, Max.
This is a show you've been trying to do for many years, Max. Is that correct?
It's true.
I can't believe it came through for you finally.
I know. It turned out I had to ask. Oh. I had to just get up the courage to ask.
You were just waiting for it to randomly come to you?
Yeah. I had been waiting to like just run into Adam Moss on the street. And
while you had like microphones in your bag and like a quiet place to
just
record?
Assault him with sound. And instead, I elected to find his email address and ask him if he wanted to come on the show. And he said yes. And so he came on the show. Adam Moss is the editor-in-chief of New York Magazine. And it's an interesting time for New York Magazine and every magazine, and we talked about that.
Also other stuff, too. It's a weird time for objects of all kinds.
It's true. It's a weird time for the world.
Adam Moss has done so much classic magazine making. New York Times Magazine.
Yep. And he's been in New York for a long time and presided over the website growing and all that stuff. And yeah, I finally asked.
It's a good time.
If you want some good times, sending out emails to all the people who want to know what you have to say, do it with MailChimp. They send out more email than anyone. Millions and millions of satisfied customers. They can't be wrong. I can't be wrong. MailChimp.
And now here's Max with Adam Moss.
Hello, Adam Moss.
Hello. Nice to be here.
It is nice to have you. We had this scheduled.
Yeah.
And then the world changed.
The world did change.
We're recording this, I guess, a week before it will air. We're recording it on a Wednesday, and it'll come out on a Wednesday, and we are a week out from the world changing.
That's true.
Have you settled into the new world?
No. Have you?
No. No. I have not. Yeah, real grieving things are still happening. I could at any point just like turn to scrambled eggs in front of you.
Yeah, well, me too.
Okay.
So we can do that together.
We can do it together. Good. Great. I'm glad to have that out there and not have to pretend like I'm not just like a pile of like lump oatmeal. As I was preparing to talk to you,
Yeah. One
of the things I listened to was this interview that you did with Brian Lehrer right after de Blasio won. And you said this thing, which I found striking, given the world changing, which was, I've got it written down here, change is always good for the magazine industry, always.
Well, I think it's good for journalism. It's what journalism is about, is change. You can't write it about something that's static. News is about what is new, so there's plenty new right now. I'm not saying it's good for the citizenry or anything like that, but yeah, I mean, for journalists, it's an extremely interesting time. There's no denying that.
Have you guys seen a spike in subscriptions like the Times and the Post?
We have seen some in subscriptions, but we've seen enormous, enormous digital audience growth. Mm. I mean, crazy. 100 plus, 120, 130% over where we were.
Did you guys have a plan for what happened if Trump won?
Not really. I have to confess that it was, you know, we were not alone in the world and basically thinking that this was impossible. And it was somewhere around, 8:30 or 9 o'clock on Tuesday night last week when it became apparent that first, that not only everything that we were planning for that night and the next morning and the next week, the next issue, had to be completely scrapped, but in fact, really, it was a whole reset on everything we do.
So what happens? Like when it's, where were you on election night when it's 8:30 and...
I was in my house with some friends. We were having dinner and, had 47 devices open and the dinner just got quieter and quieter. And then really the people we were having dinner with just had to leave. They couldn't bear to be there anymore. And I switched immediately into journalist mode and had to sort of be in kind of constant contact with the people who were manning and womaning, you know, our election night coverage. And, you know, we really, all the things set to go were all presuming a Hillary victory at different sizes. But it was, I'd say around, you know, 9 o'clock when it was just, okay, you know, I hate to make everyone do this because I still don't expect this to be the outcome, but we really need to just start writing as if. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, by the time, I'd say, I don't know, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock came by, it was just more and more likely. And then there was all those hours when it was obvious what was happening, but no one was calling the election.
Right.
And so the question was, when do we release this out into the world? And what do we think is a credible moment to basically be writing in the tense of Donald Trump being the next president?
What's New York Magazine's job in that moment when you, like everyone else who lives within like 50 miles of us right now, didn't think this was going to happen? And you guys missed it like everyone else missed it.
We certainly did.
How do you talk? What's your job to your audience at that point when you've missed something like this?
Well, I mean, it's basically to try to be smart and make sense of the moment with the talent that we have. And they're going to be thinking about this. And I mean, they've been hired for certain reasons. And their minds are basically why they've been hired, and the force of their writing. And sort of let them loose and help the reader understand, but also trying to give them some sense of comfort, or at least comfort in a community. Mm-hmm. Of people who might be feeling the same things. And it was very interesting to me that, you know, certain pieces just kept circulating. And actually, Andrew Sullivan had written this The Tyranny piece, which was...
I reread it this weekend. It continues to be the most, like, the smartest thing I've read about the election since Election Day, and he wrote it in May.
I mean, his prescience was unbelievable. And at the time, I have to say that, you know, he and I had a sort of playful exchange about, you know, you're such a catastrophist. And
we should just say basically, like, in May, Andrew Sullivan wrote a piece about why America was ripe for what he called tyranny. And he basically spells out, this is before Trump had completely sewn up the nomination.
Right. It was just almost at that moment. And no one, you know, it was, everyone thought that even if he'd sewed up the nomination, it was essentially inconsequential because people didn't have it. There was no room in people's imagination to believe that this could possibly happen.
Neither was there on the morning of November 8th.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
But what happened, I mean, he basically lays out how this could go. And at the time I read it, and it felt like sort of like dystopian fan fiction.
Absolutely. You know, and I remember, you know, I texted him, I don't know, it was probably about 9:30, and just said, I hate that you were right. And he said, I hate it too. But he was unbearably prescient. And since the election, that story written again in May, I mean, it has never really not been in the top 20, 30 pieces that we have up at any one time that people are reading. And since the election, every day, it's one of the top pieces that's being circulated everywhere.
It was, I would recommend that people read it, but it was a terrifying experience to read because I remember this exchange that I'd had with my dad. My dad called me after he read it and was like, I am scared about the country in a way I've never been before.
Yeah.
And I was like, come on, it's going to be fine. Like, he's just trying to stir stuff up, you know? Nope, that was right.
But I do believe that there's some solace in wisdom. You know, it's you don't have to just give people good news. You can, if you can help them understand what's going on, I think you've done a service.
What is that service now for you? So at some point, the shock of this will wear off. At some point, like, my scrambled eggs-ness will, you know, solidify. And what is the role of New York Magazine in Trump's America?
You know, I think it's to hold it accountable, to try to understand not just what happened, but what is happening. I mean, I think that we have to move pretty quickly now. We're in it. And We have to understand it. I hope our role also is to actually report from inside it, not just comment on it. But it's all part of the mission to try to be as intelligent about it and as, in some cases, as tough about it as we possibly can.
Do you feel like part of, you know, I don't know what you think about this as like someone who's running a magazine called New York, but do you think that part of your job and part of the magazine's job is to try and break whatever echo chamber was in place? You know, I mean, there's been a lot of conversation about this to America's.
You know, yes.
It's like, at least in my life in New York, I wasn't talking to people who thought this could happen.
Right.
And I wonder now what magazines like yours, whether you feel a responsibility to pierce that.
Well, you would like to. I mean, it's, you know, it's certainly a goal, but I think maybe a utopian one. There's been a lot of, obviously, a lot of criticism of the media for not breaking out of its bubble. And I think the media actually, I mean, you can look at the media at different stages of this whole thing, but the certainly the last 5 months, there was some incredibly strong reporting. And I, you know, I don't think there was any dereliction of duty in sort of helping people understand what the stakes really were here. But we didn't reach most of us outside of our bubble. But I think that's really, it has to do with changes in technology, changes the way people get information. It's kind of beyond the performance of any one medium. And I think a magazine whose name is New York does understand that it's speaking to a certain audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's talking to that audience.
Right.
It wants to engage that audience in the way that that audience needs to be engaged.
Well, that's why I ask, because it's like, it's...
But we're never, that white-collar worker in Detroit is not going to read us.
Right.
So there's no, I don't think there's any obligation to actually go and speak to them, but we actually, we have to help our own audience understand them. Yes, definitely.
I think that's right. I think what you're saying is right. Because there has been this push over the last week of like, we need to figure out how to break these barriers down and talk across these bridges and all these things. And it's like, that does feel utopian to me. And if you spend all your time trying to get a white collar worker in Detroit to read New York Magazine, like in the process, New York Magazine might get kind of shitty for the people who actually read it.
Yeah, it might.
You maybe can't do both.
And it's out of our control anyway. I mean, it's, you know, people... us, everyone else. I mean, you know, we reach most people through social media. We reach most people through Facebook, and or not most, but a really strikingly large number. And those people are choosing what to put in their feed. They have control. We can just put stuff out there and be interesting enough that they want to share stories we write. But ultimately, you know, there is no one authority. New York Times is not an authority that has obviously broke down way before this election. And all you can do is your best work and hope that it means something to the audience that's reading it, whoever that is.
I talked to someone on your staff this morning and they said that you seemed invigorated.
Well, you know, there's no question that there's a lot going on. And that sort of turmoil, it's not just interesting in and of itself, but it surfaces sort of very large questions about how we live in the world, how we live in a democracy, our relationship to government, our relationship to each other. All of that stuff is, you know, that's incredible material.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we're in this business, is to try to, you know, make sense of change. And you know, as I said, there is quite a bit of change.
Can you remember a time in your career where the stakes have felt this high?
You know, I suppose right after 9/11, and I, you know, I think this is still about 9/11, by the way.
How so?
Well, I mean, I think that the world, the sort of global nature of the world changed. I mean, the sort of the ways in which no one felt particularly safe in whatever world that they lived in, that sense of peril, of fear, while not being absolutely present on the surface, has never really left us, and affects different people different ways. And
I wasn't here. I was really far away on September 11th, and I was like halfway across the world and stayed there for like months.
Uh-huh.
And but Wednesday, November 9th, felt like I imagined it must have felt,
well,
without this, like without the violence.
Yeah, and with and you know, and it's, yes. I mean, there was that same actual physical silence. I mean, you get on the subway on the Wednesday subway. A week ago today, and people weren't talking to each other. People were sitting in stony silence, just staring out like zombies.
There was not a sound on the train, but like a third of those zombies on my car were crying.
Yeah.
You know, it felt like this citywide funeral.
Yeah.
And it's so rare that this place, everyone is focused on one thing. It's so rare that you can walk down the street and know that everyone's thinking about the same thing.
Yeah, that's true. And yet the other thing that happens is that actually strangers talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been in, you know, grocery store lines and things like that, and everybody wants to talk about this. My, you know, got a haircut, and like, you know, that every single chair was, you know, on this.
I was in Chicago this weekend, and every single place I went, like, airport, Uber driver,
right,
nothing else.
And that was actually a phenomenon of 9/11 too, is that there was a community being built at the same time, and I think that there's something of that going on now, even if there's an aspect of what's going on within our world where people are tearing each other to pieces.
Yeah, well, you know, anytime you feel like scrambled eggs, you got to tear someone to hell. Hey, I'm going to put things on hold for a second and tell you quickly about some sponsors making today's show possible. If you've been listening to this show since the beginning, then you know that there is a fourth co-host, and she doesn't say very much, but she has been present for many of our favorite interviews. The co-host is Reba, my dog. And finally, Reba is going to get her due on the Long Form Podcast, because this week our sponsor is BarkBox. And BarkBox is a company that sends awesome stuff every month to your house for your dog. I have gotten one of these boxes, and it had like insane great treats. Reba likes me way more at the park now. They had all kinds of toys that she didn't like devour in 30 seconds. They actually lasted. She was so psyched. She was super psyched. I opened this box and it was just like a world of glorious Reba magic. And your dog too can be that psyched if you go with BarkBox. They've got a bunch of different plans. You can do a 1 month or a 6 month or a 12 month plan. You can cancel anytime. It's totally free shipping. Make your dog happy. Go to BarkBox.com/longform. That's BarkBox.com/longform. And when you sign up for a 6 or 12 month plan, you'll get a free month of BarkBox. Free box of glorious magic for your dog. Go do it. Also sponsoring the show this week, Squarespace, the website that makes it so easy to build websites that maybe even Reba could build one. I wonder what Reba's website would be like. I feel like it'd be like, it'd be like some combination of just like peanut butter and napping. It would be all peanut butter and napping themed. Anyway, Squarespace. Squarespace is it is that easy. It makes it that easy to build a website. You don't need to know a lick of code. Everything is drag and drop. It looks super professional. They've got these beautiful themes that work on any device. And they've got themes for any kind of website you can imagine. A personal portfolio, something for your business, a one-off project, something that's about peanut butter and napping. If you need a website, if you have a website you've been meaning to build, Squarespace is the answer. Go to squarespace.com, free trial, no credit card required. When you do decide to make a purchase, use the offer code LONGFORM at checkout. You'll get 10% off. Squarespace, set your website apart. All right, let's get back to Adam. All right, let's talk about you.
All right.
Okay.
What do you want to know?
You have had this very interesting career. I'm going to try and run through it quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Born in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Grew up in Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Oberlin.
Mm-hmm.
Left Oberlin. Spent 6 months as like a copy boy at the New York Times.
9 months maybe, but something like that.
All right. A handful of months, uh-huh. Copy boy at the New York Times. Did not like that, is my understanding.
You've read well.
I'm trying to zoom through this stuff that like magazine stuff.
Well, I mean, it's not that I didn't like it. It's the copy class that I was in. They were all people who were very serious about newspapers. And actually, my interest was magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of got this job by accident. So So I just felt kind of out of place. I had, you know, it was an amazing job to be a copy boy at the New York Times in 1979, which is the year that it was.
That's the gig, right?
Yeah.
Like you were like the editor of your college paper. That's the best thing you can get.
Absolutely the, you know, the best job. And I worked, actually, I even had a better gig, which is like worked at night so that I could write stories during the day. But that whole, it was like this whole, you know, I was very fortunate that this whole thing was available to me, but it wasn't what I wanted. What I wanted was to be a magazine editor, which was an incredibly strange career goal at that point. No one wanted to be an editor.
And you were super clear on that, like, when you got out of school?
I kind of was, yeah. I don't know why. It's what I wanted. And I was doing, actually, I was, I had two gigs simultaneously, which is that I was working at the New York Times at night, and I was also working as an intern at Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone had started an offshoot called College Papers, which was run by Jan Wenner's really wonderful sister, Kate Wenner. And so she just hired three of us who had just graduated college to try to make a magazine for people in college. And I really loved that. Mm-hmm. But it was an internship. I wasn't being paid. I had to get paid. So I worked at the New York Times, and then she gave me a job. So I left, and the shock to me later was that I would spend so much of my career at the New York Times, which I did, you'll get to, I'm sure, as you're running through my career.
We will get there. But I in that moment when, I mean, A, like knowing that clearly what you want to do at that age, I find striking.
Mm.
It's like I
was a weird mutant.
Like I did not have any ideas myself.
Yeah.
What other ways did your weird mutantness manifest?
You know, everyone else was just, it wasn't like these days where, you know, kids are super anxious about what they're going to do for a living and all that stuff. And when I graduated college, I mean, I'm 59 years old, and nobody had ambition not many people, not certainly not any graduate from Oberlin. You just kind of wanted to sort of screw around mm-hmm. and enjoy your youth. And I guess I regretted that later, but I at the time I just was like, no, I really want to work. I really like this work. It's like makes me excited and happy.
Youth and is for the weak.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had no problem with anyone else doing what they were doing. But for me, it was, you know, I had grown up reading magazines. I was an adolescent and a sort of growing up person during an incredibly exciting period for magazines. And, you know, what was happening in New York magazine was happening at The New Yorker and Rolling Stone and especially, I guess, Esquire at the time. And
you were like a kid, high school kid on Long Island reading Esquire?
Oh, my God, yes. I loved magazines. I don't know. I'm a freak. And so that's just what I wanted to do. And I was happy that I got to do that.
Were you clear then that you wanted to edit, not write?
Yeah. Because I tried writing, and I sort of sucked at it. Mostly what it was that I was an editor writing, which is, you know, when an editor writes, that thing comes down, and they start to question every single word that they say, and mm-hmm. that's a terrible, terrible state for a writer to be in. Also, I found writing just incredibly isolating, lonely. You know, whereas magazines were like, this was fun, this was kindergarten. You were just making a, you know, blocks project together. And I that was my excitement, is working with other people and making this thing together. So you couldn't really do that as a writer.
There wasn't some part of you that was like, if I just like plug away at this, I'll get better at it?
Well, I was always pretty bad at thinking that I like to do things I was good at. Mm-hmm. I was kind of, it took me a long time to accept that there was value in doing something that you weren't good at. And I was actually a pretty good editor from the beginning, and I was sort of better at helping other people than I was at doing the thing myself.
All right, so Rolling Stone, you're like, New York Times, thanks but no thanks. All you guys can chase your like Metro desk dreams, but mm-hmm. I'm gonna go make magazines,
something like that,
and you end up at Esquire.
Well, I ended up at Rolling Stone.
Oh, right, Rolling Stone.
I ended up at Rolling Stone. And we were doing this kind of weird project because Rolling Stone College Papers, that was what it was called, terrible name, was really doing what Rolling Stone itself used to be doing. It was just that Rolling Stone had turned into a something of a more corporate or Hollywood, at that moment in its life, more Hollywood-driven and wasn't really dealing with the youth of America. And so this magazine was about the youth of America. So, but it didn't last. It lasted three issues. And at that point, I had this weird expertise, which was Theoretically, I knew something about college students. So Esquire, if for those people who are old enough to remember the old Esquire, every September used to do a college issue, which was always one of the better issues of the year. And so they were looking for exactly me. They were looking for somebody who was young enough but had a certain experience dealing with, like, the ideas of collegeness. So I always wanted to work at Esquire, and so they hired me. And then the day I got to Esquire, they folded the college issue. But it was too late. They'd already hired me.
Like, literally the day you got there?
Absolutely the day I got there.
When on your first day were you told that the thing you'd been hired to do no longer existed?
Lunchtime. But that was fine. I was in the door, and it was a magazine nerd like me, it was a great thing, because it had been bought by these two guys from Tennessee, Chris Whittle and Philip Moffitt, and they were insecure enough about their ability to make a great magazine because they didn't have that kind of experience that they went and hired all the old great magazine talents from the Harold Hayes days. Byron Dobell and Lee Eisenberg and a number of other people, Adam Smith or Jerry Goodman was his real name. And so I not only was at Esquire at that time, but I was there with the people I had revered. And they taught me tons. And, I felt super fortunate about that.
I feel like there's this thing that I've encountered a lot in, like, institutions like Esquire, these, like, big media organizations, where there's a certain kind of young person who's ambitious but not necessarily looking to, like, be a big name, or doesn't want to be forward. Like, to, mm-hmm.
Doesn't want to be a writer. Yeah.
Yeah. And knows how to talk to older people.
Yeah, I guess I was always good at knowing how to talk to older people.
You know that kind of person.
Although
though,
I just blew it, over and over again at the beginning, because I was, while I was in awe of a lot of the sort of famous people that I was working with, I also had, like, really pretty strong ideas. So I would talk to them in a way I didn't have practice learning how you're supposed to talk to a writer, and learning how to talk to talent, and learning how fragile the ego of a talented person is, always almost. And that's a skill you learn as an editor growing up. They just would hand me, I remember this piece by William Buckley that I was handed, and it was gibberish. I mean, he did not speak English. I mean, he was obviously a pretty smart dude and complicated person. But, on a pure, like, just communicating, what the hell are you saying? Right. And I wrote him back. And in those days, that's what you did. You wrote, you typed the thing on a typewriter, and then you put a stamp on it, and you sent it in the mail. And, a week later, you got a response, and he wrote me back. I can't remember the exact line, but it was a one sentence, fuck you. And with the, I think at that point I even had killed the story, and he had, and sent him a kill fee, which came back in shreds. He'd torn up the check.
Where did that confidence come from?
Not me. Strangely parented, I guess. I had, really from reading a lot. I knew what I liked, and I just had some ideas about what I wanted to do. And I was at Esquire then for another 7 years. And then I got restless. I guess this is more arrogance. And I, wanted to run my own thing. And 29, and I had made a prototype for a magazine I wanted to do, and showed it around. And there was this one consultant guy, his name is Jack Berkowitz, and he looked at this thing and he said, this idea is just absolutely terrible.
What was the idea?
It was a magazine called Manhattan, I think. It had a certain resemblance to what eventually became 7 Days, which I'll get to. So I had done this thing, but it was, like, really just boneheaded about the business. It was, like, so naive about how you find a reader and how you can make a business out of that reader.
You can say that now, but at the time, did you feel like you, like, had it all figured out?
No. I actually knew that this was idiotic, but I really had so much fun doing it. I did it with friends of mine, and it was, like, super fun. So, like, 6 months later, Leonard Stern, who owned the Village Voice at the time, was actually looking to start another magazine. He was having a kind of bake-off, and that all he knew was that he wanted another magazine that maybe, that wasn't quite so pinko as the Village Voice was. And he put out a kind of open call, and everybody just went and presented their ideas. And his consultant was this guy, Jack Berkowitz. And Jack Berkowitz said, you know, you should really, like, go and talk to these guys and, like, here, retool your thing and present it. And my meeting was at 10 at night.
Really?
In a skyscraper, you know, in Midtown Manhattan. And
you were 29?
I was 29, maybe even 28.
What'd you wear?
Oh man, I don't remember.
I mean, like, did,
but I'm sure I wore a suit.
Like that's what
I must have worn a suit. and he was just silent as I presented, and I really thought I had completely blown it. And I was so awkward and sweating and incredibly uncomfortable. I raced to the bathroom, just pissing, and he came into the bathroom and took the urinal next to me and said, like your idea, let's do it.
And that's you're just like eyes facing forward.
Absolutely. Okay. And that was how 7 Days started. And,
wow.
And then I did that for 2 years. So and that was like just as fun as you can ever have ever in this business.
You got to tell me a little bit about it, because I couldn't find one.
Yeah.
I went and looked and I couldn't find them.
Yeah, well, they're hard to find.
What was 7 Days?
Well, what it was at the time and what it seems in retrospect are kind of different. So what it was at the time was just a magazine about politics, culture, and, you know, lifestyle, I guess. And it was a lot of very, very short pieces, which was mainly for economic reasons. We couldn't really afford long pieces. And I was getting a lot of people to write for more or less for free. And this is what they would do. And it was, I assembled this amazing staff of people who didn't really care if they made any money or didn't care if they worked in a fancy magazine. They just kind of wanted to do something fun. And we put out this thing, which really was so amateurish, I can't even tell you. But it was colloquial in a way that actually was kind of way ahead of its time. It really sounded like blog writing.
I was just about to say, are you about to take credit for the voice of the internet?
We kind of tripped into this thing that
lots of exclamation points.
Yeah, right. That later other people invented. And it lasted 2 years, and then it went out of business as a sort of consequence of there was a big economic recession in New York at that time.
What did it feel like to finally be running your own thing?
Oh, it was great fun. I mean, but it was basically great fun because, you know, everyone was my age. It was just, we were all just playing. And it was so, there were no expectations of it. You weren't working for, you know, Condé Nast or Hearst, and no one was on your back. It was just essentially like an alternative or college newspaper that was, we were too stupid to know what was not cool, what was not the kind of thing you did. It was like, no, you didn't, you know, later on, I would and still do say to younger people, no, that's just not going to work. Trust me, I've done it before. And then I wasn't ever saying that because I hadn't done it before. And so, you know, we did a lot of things that, you know, a more seasoned editor would have said, oh, no, don't do that.
Is there like something that you have in your head when you say that?
No, although one of the things that, like, these days I'm reminded of is there was a running subtext during the whole run of 7 Days, which was this war with Donald Trump over this piece we wrote about. He was having trouble filling his buildings, and that his claims of success as a real estate mogul were false. Really kind of amazing in retrospect. And he was, you know, he went kind of apeshit at us, and then also at Leonard Stern, a fellow billionaire who was his sort of colleague in that world. Lately I've just been remembering.
Have you ever met him?
Trump? Yeah. I mean, not in any personal way, but I've been, you know, I've been at events with him, and he once tweeted out that I was an idiot. So that's good.
President called you an idiot.
Pretty good, right?
Yeah, congratulations.
It's like being on the enemies list.
We're joking. There actually is an enemies list. I'm going to go back to scrambled eggs. Let's keep going. 7 Days ends, and then there was this period of time where, as far as I can tell, you started working as a consultant at the Times, but also you were like thinking about doing another one.
I had another magazine idea.
The Industry.
It was called The Industry. And it was a magazine that was making the case that the movie business and the book business and the music business and ultimately the internet, actually, which was just beginning at that moment, were all basically one industry, and that was the ideas industry. And this was a, you know, it was a magazine of ideas, but also of, you know, gossip and fun. So there was all this stuff smushing together, and I raised a whole bunch of money, but not enough money. And eventually I just decided to give it up, which I'm, you know, in retrospect, as I look back on my whole career, I'm totally happy that I never got to do this magazine, because I think it would have been not a good magazine. And I also think it would have been a misery to actually do. But at that point, well, because it was a magazine about moguls, and to have to like deal with moguls as your subject, and also one of the flaws of the whole idea was that the people who were going to eventually pay for it were in fact the people who it was about. Right. And that's always a tricky and I think dangerous thing to do in journalism. Anyway, I was at the New York Times as a consultant at the same time because I had to be making some money and was enjoying being back at the New York Times and sort of going wherever anyone wanted me to go. And so I would be at Metro for a little while. I would be at business section for a little while. But they wouldn't let me anywhere near the magazine, which is the only thing that I really kind of knew anything about. I really didn't know anything about the things I was consulting with them about. And then eventually, Jack Rosenthal, who was the editorial page editor, became the editor of the magazine. And he said, you know, I actually would like someone who knows something about magazines here. And then eventually said, basically, you have to take a job. You can't just do this as a consultant anymore. So I took a job and then was the editorial director and then eventually the editor of the Times Magazine for 12 years total all of that time.
12 years at the Times?
13 if you count the consulting, yeah.
Okay. Here are some questions I have about those 13 years that you just flew through.
Yeah.
One question I have is there's like not a lot about you out there, which is striking for someone who's like been running these magazines for a good long while. There's certainly not a lot of writing by you, and there's not even that much writing about you. But a lot of it is from that period of time. Like most of what I could find is about like that kind of consulting transitioning to magazine time at the Times. And the tone of all of it, if I could just like paraphrase it, is like
sneering.
There's some of it is sneering, but it didn't read that way. I mean, if you can like understand where the sneering is coming from, the sneering doesn't feel that powerful. What I read it as was like basically this person is making the New York Times cool.
Well, that's a very generous way of looking at it. It was, but you know, I think that most of it was I was a very foreign idea at the New York Times. They almost never would let someone from the outside in. It's way different now, the paper, I mean, in that respect. But in those days, it's like you got there at the very beginning and you grew up there and it was all ingrown talent and they did very little hiring from without, and especially my background was completely bizarre. And then what I did once I got to the magazine was had definite ideas about what a magazine was, and I did not think the New York Times Magazine was a magazine, and I thought it could be. And so, and Joe Lelyveld and Max Frankel allowed me to define it on different terms than had been defined before. So it used to be the sort of illustrated version of the New York Times. We really were able to make it a magazine that had the sort of principles, including subjectivity, an alien idea at the Times, and we were able to hire people who were great magazine writers, and so we were able to hire Michael Pollan and Michael Lewis and Lynn Hirschberg and Andrew Sullivan and a whole host of people who they're some of the great long form writers of magazines ever.
Were there challenges in trying to convince those folks to come write for you?
Well, once they felt that they would be safe there and that, you know, the notorious New York Times copy desk wouldn't destroy their work or things like that. And, they, you know, like in anything else, it's contagious. You publish something that people like, that they want to be part of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone, given the reach of the New York Times and the halo of the New York Times authority, it was ultimately it was very easy to get writers to write for the Times then because the audience was just fantastic.
The other tone of all these things that got written about you in that time is like the word like wunderkind is all over it, you know? So I'm interested in what navigating that place as this like outsider who knew about magazines and who had left the Times and starts bringing in these big names and trying to do something different with the magazine. Like what was hard for you then?
Well, I mean, I suppose the New York Times itself, the people who worked at the New York Times, I mean, in a, just a technical sense, we were doing stories that were in competition with the desks of the New York Times. So that, I mean, this is still a problem at the New York Times Magazine.
Right, that dynamic's not gone.
That dynamic's not gone away. But but for my era, I was lucky enough that the mandate was just make a great magazine, period. That's it. So remember, Michael Kelly did this, what became a kind of legendary piece called Saint Hillary, just after Hillary Clinton became first lady. And there were so many other people who wanted to be writing and wanted to get that time with Hillary Clinton, and we did. And so we were, that competition was fostered as opposed to silenced.
Mm-hmm. Did you like that competition? Like, are you a competitive guy?
Well, no, I am definitely a competitive guy. But I didn't, it was just basically having to sit through a lot of people yelling at me.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, well, it's part of the job. It's always part of the job.
What was the part of the job that you really loved? Like, what was the best part of it for you?
I'd say, you know, the words and the pictures. You know, in the end, you know, we were able to publish some really great journalism, and I do love a great story.
Were you good at being a boss?
I don't know. You have to ask the people. I mean, I developed, like everyone does, a certain way of being. I mean, my essential mode of bossness is to nudge and nudge and nudge and just be a pain in the ass. I don't yell at people. I don't, you know, I'm not like that kind of person, but I am really irritating. and so I just would push and push and push. And a lot of good work was done. So I don't know whether that was because of me or what.
You can take a little bit.
Whatever. But I've always hired well.
Tell me what you're looking for in a writer, and then tell me what you're looking for in an editor.
Well, the same thing. It's just basically about how they think and how they express themselves. And you know, when I'm looking at new people, whether they can think in a way that will add to what we're doing and not duplicate what we're doing, that they speak in our language, but they're challenging each other. The space that they occupy actually grows because you hire them rather than shrinks. And that's what I look for in both a writer and an editor.
And how do you figure out how people think?
You know, you read them. That's one way. And you talk to them. That's the other way. It's not actually that complicated. We're always hiring. And I would say that it's absolutely true that you always know in the first 2 minutes whether this is going to work out.
Really? It was always that way for you? Or like now you've developed like your
No, I think
sense.
It's always been.
Really?
And I think anyone who hires doesn't say that is a liar.
Really?
You go through the motions of the conversation and the great interviews you have with people are like people who at the end you've actually learned something about what you do.
Hmm.
And sometimes that happens and it is thrilling. It's great.
Ah, such an optimistic way to think about that process.
Well, it's, you know, it's good. It's fun. It's one of the things I like doing.
How much time do you spend doing that?
Oh, it's way too much.
How much of your time, I don't want to totally lose the thread on our chronology here, but running New York Magazine, like what percentage of your time is managing people and hiring people? And
I would say managing people and, you know, people is like 70% of, at the sort of level I'm at, and really any person who runs a magazine or magazine and websites or whatever. Yeah, management is what you do, man. It's you are completely dependent on other people to do great work, and so you have to make sure that they are given room to do that work and get along with each other and are inspired and all that stuff. And that's managing.
Does it feel like a necessary evil to be able to deal with all the words and pictures, or do you actually like
that part
of it? Oh,
no, I love that, and I wish to God. I mean, the one of the good and bad things about New York Magazine at this point is that it's way larger than it was, and so the larger you get, the more managing you have to do, and it squeezes out the time that you can spend on the actual journalism. I still get to do quite a bit of it, and I love it, but it becomes less and less because you're... I mean, especially now, I mean, I'm really skipping ahead. You know, you're constantly trying to figure out how to maneuver through just enormous changes in business models and things like that and how that affects journalism.
We got to talk about that, but I'm not going to, even though that was an amazing segue, I'm not going to give you Tell me about the transition from leaving the Times and going to New York. Why did you leave?
So when Bruce Wasserstein bought New York Magazine, and they were doing a kind of listening tour of people telling them what they thought the magazine needed at that point, I was on the tour, and I knew that it was all a sort of covert job interview. And I thought, you know, I might actually want to do this. And even though I'd had, I suppose, a good career at the Times ahead of me, New York had been a magazine that I had loved very much back when I was a teenager.
Yeah, Clay Felker days.
In Clay Felker days. And I was excited about the opportunity to have a shot at editing it, and I got that opportunity.
Do you, like, put on a suit for your presentation?
For that, God, I don't even remember. Look at me now. You can't see it on this podcast, but I now, you know, I'm jeans and t-shirts, and, you know, it's the olden days when I used to, like, suit up to go to work and used to feel that especially the boss guy should be, like, you know, all buttoned up and dressed up, and so the people would respect the man. That's gone.
I'm so glad I missed that era. I would have failed in that era miserably. So you go to this new place, this new place, and you have now been there for a while.
12 years, almost 13.
13 years.
Mm.
That's a long time.
Yeah.
There have been some changes in the industry over those 13 years.
There have, yes. Changes in the industry and changes in the world.
I feel like the one thing I have heard you talk a lot about is the transition from print to digital and all of that stuff. Although at the same time, you guys have done a really good job with
Thanks.
That. And I wonder what you think of as the keys to that success.
We actually had a profitable, back in 2005, we had a profitable web operation. And the reason is arcane. I'm not going to even bother with that, but it had to do with the digital part of the magazine had been created in partnership with Cablevision that wanted fashion as part of what they were doing. And fashion was, you know, a luxury product. And if you were an early adapting luxury advertiser, you would go to us because we were the only ones doing it. So if you had a runway show for Marc Jacobs, we would have that. But we were profitable. So that basically, I mean, I had just come from the New York Times, and where they were sort of the whole sort of web operation was aborning. And I was very excited about that, actually. I mean, I remember, you know, for instance, 9/11 at the New York Times, you know, we made a really one of the issues of a magazine that I'm most proud of in my whole life in 3 days, because 9/11 was a Tuesday and we had to close on a Friday. And we didn't want to wait those 10 days. And so we just put it up. And I thought, oh my God, what a miracle the internet is. You could actually just sort of push a button and publish, and instantly it was there. And so I was, unlike other magazine editors who were nervous or scared or basically cynical about the internet, I was a great enthusiast or excited about it. And so we started a news operation. I mean, and basically that's all we did. We just, like, we believed in news. We didn't believe you just put the magazine up there. We believed that there was a different kind of way to write and a different kind of journalism that could be done in this other medium. And even in those early days, we just simply did it. And we did it in sort of news first and then food and eventually, and, you know, Vulture Entertainment and the Cut for fashion and et cetera. And then we had a principle, which was the magazine itself had these constituent parts. It was a general interest magazine, and so it was easy to just strip each of the parts and make a digital magazine out of that with the same point of view. And I think really the answer to your question is, it's the same point of view, is that there is a kind of, we're one of the things that the internet has given us entirely is that even the whole magazine is mostly read. I mean, the magazine is read physically by people who read it, and that's fantastic. But its essential audience is through the web. So, that's where you get the millions of readers as opposed to the hundreds of thousands of readers. Suddenly, the magazine itself had to change. The magazine itself became national and international because New York was actually too small. Mm-hmm. So the magazine was no longer, and in fact, it really never was entirely about the sort of concrete jungle of New York City. But it was now about a certain way of looking at the world. It was about a sort of New York cosmopolitan view of things. It kind of gets back to the question of how do you talk to the blue-collar worker. The magazine was never about the blue-collar worker. The magazine was always about, I mean, originally it was just for New Yorkers, but eventually it became New Yorker-like people, whether they lived in L.A. or San Francisco or London or Paris. And that principle is very easy. Once you, it's very clear. And so once it became sort of obvious that that's what we were doing, we were just, it was a sort of, suddenly we were a magazine of sensibility, not of place, then everything else followed pretty easily.
What role did quality play in the kind of work you were trying to do on the web? Like, were you focused on it being as good as what was in the magazine? Were you not worried about that? Were you willing for the bar to go lower? Like, how did you think about that?
Well, I mean, the quality standard had to be the same. It's just that what constituted quality in a web story was definitely going to be different than a magazine story. Mm-hmm. A web story is mostly written relatively quickly. And so that you didn't have those sort of layers and layers and layers of thinking and rethinking and rethinking and editing and reshaping and all of that stuff.
As an editor, how do you calibrate for that? How do you know something's good?
Don't you know?
No, I'm not the editor of New York Magazine. I don't just know.
You know, it's like, you know, we've published some stuff that I think is not great. And they're definitely, you know, it's like the old definition of obscenity. You know quality when you see it. Yeah. Is it smart? Is it well written? Does it make you laugh? Does it make you cry? Does it make you think? You know, these are all things that you apply, whether it's a, you know, 8,000 word story that's been reported over 5 months or something that someone had to sit there, you know, as the election returns are coming in and write in an hour and get out.
There are a handful of people who were with you at the New York Times Magazine and are with you now at New York. And I'm interested in those relationships with writers and from your perspective, why those work, why those people come with you. Like, help me understand the relationship with Andrew Sullivan or Frank Rich or, uh-huh. or one of these people you've been editing for
right.
20 years.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, most magazine editors have certain writers they've had long relationships with. You know, I've known Frank Rich since Esquire. He's my friend. Andrew's also my friend. We have enormous respect for each other. I think he has respect for me, but I have huge respect for both Frank and Andrew, just to name two. I think writers go where they feel safe, appreciated, where they believe in the values of editing. Some places are really in opposition to the editors are in opposition to writers. That happens a lot.
And what does that look like? Help me understand what that looks like.
You know, the editors resent the writers and the writers resent the editors. It's like bad blood that happens.
It sounds terrible.
Well, it's because the they don't appreciate, they're not basically empathetic about the other's problems. That the editors are worried about deadlines and they're worried about the mechanics and they're worried about things fitting and they're worried about that sort of thing. And they're impatient with the writers who are slow or whose thinking may not yet be so perfectly formed. And therefore the editors have to do more work and they resent the work. Or the editor has one idea and the writer has another idea and they're itself at war. I mean, especially given a place where the ideas themselves come mostly from editors and the editor kind of imagines what the piece will be. And then the writer will always write something different. And I think that's a great thing. But sometimes it can get frustrating from an editor's point of view. So, you know, some places that's badly negotiated. I mean, it's intrinsic. In some places that's badly negotiated. And I hope where we are, it feels like a partnership.
And is part of your job just like maintaining tons of those partnerships? Is that like part of your value as the editor?
I guess so. I mean, it's, you know, and it's all about human beings. So you are dealing with a whole mess of human beings who are creative people, and so yeah, inevitably, quite a bit of your job is making sure that they can do their best work and are happy doing it.
When does that get hard? What after being in New York for almost 13 years? Like, what's hard about that now for you?
That part of it's not hard. You know, the hard part is constantly figuring out, you know, assaults on the business model and how journalism changes because of it or doesn't. What are the standards that are actually most important? Those kinds of questions are hard and also interesting. Mm-hmm. So,
how do you gauge the success of a story? One thing that I think has come out of this era of this digital moment where you can track things in mm-hmm. a way that we never could before is I think there's a very understandable sort of human nature tendency to write things that will do well and write things that will get like
traffic.
Yeah, traffic.
That horrible word, traffic.
Well, that's one part of it for sure. And then uh-huh. there's this other part, which is like they'll just get clapped for, you know? Mm-hmm. By people who spend their day clapping.
Yeah, like especially do incredibly well on social media and,
for example,
you know,
yeah.
Twitter.
Yeah. How much does that affect like the way that you assign stories now? How much does that affect the way you think about this stuff?
One of the things that we found, it doesn't really affect it. I mean, one of the things that we found over time is that the best work gets read. And that's that. So you don't actually... you don't edit cynically. I know people probably don't believe that, but one doesn't really edit cynically.
Convince them.
You don't. Well, there's no way to do it except to tell you that it's true. And that that in general, when you've published a good piece, most of the time, not all of the time, but most of the time, it will get found and read. And look, that's why we're all doing this. You don't want to publish a piece that nobody is interested in. So there is a kind of positive conspiracy between audience size and good editing and good writing and good publishing.
Looking back through that career, a consistent theme in this is you looking for another thing.
Yeah.
And now it seems like you're in this place where maybe you're not. And I wondered whether there was ever any part of you that wants to go off and do something from scratch?
No, I mean, I think one of the, for better or worse, and both is the truth. You're in constant entrepreneurial mode these days as a journalist. You are constantly having to reinvent things. And, you know, we just started an e-commerce site called The Strategist, which is and our approach to it was journalistic and like to make great writing, which would be about things that you might want to buy. And it's great. Let me just say this, like, plug that right now. It's like it's actually great journalism of a certain kind. And I hope it's also a good business.
Feels weird to ask you this question given the apocalypse, but how do you stay engaged? Like, how are you not bored?
Oh my God. It is weird to say that. How could you be bored? It's so interesting.
It's always so interesting. Like, you've been doing this for so long. It doesn't get boring.
You know, it's different every day. You walk in every day. The world is different. There's different stuff to, you know, what a privilege to, be in a position where you're being paid to pay attention to a changing world. It's like, you know, it's fun. It's hard. But it's, you know, most people just have their dinner conversation to vent this stuff. And, you know, we have magazines.
Adam, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor this week was Mickey Kapper. Our intern was Courtney Harrell. Thanks to them. Thanks to our sponsors, our friends at MailChimp, BarkBox, Squarespace, and SockFancy. Get yourself some socks delivered to your house every month. Go to sockfancy.com/longform to get a free pair of socks added to your box. But thanks, of course, most of all, to Adam Moss. He doesn't do a lot of interviews, and I appreciate him doing that one. We'll see you next week.